Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. After the 2008 financial crash, Wall Street went through a sort of forced identity crisis, as politicians and the public in general called for big changes to the banks that had been in things like the credit default swap and mortgage-backed securities. The industry nevertheless found a way to rebuild, thrive, and in the eyes of many, not really learn many lessons. In his new book, Young Money, New York Magazine's Kevin Roos profiles 8 entry-level Wall Street bankers who all entered the industry after the crash. It's a story about how Wall Street life is different and how it's the same as it ever was. It's a story about long hours, huge bonuses, some partying, and Excel spreadsheets. Lots and lots of Excel spreadsheets. Kevin Roos, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
I want to focus first on the 2 chapters that we have on our website at WNYC.org. Click on the Brian Lehrer Show page. We have chapters 1 and 3 there. You begin by profiling a Wall Street banker named Arjun Khan, born in Queens. First off, is this his real name or did you change the name of your subjects?
I had to change all the names of the subjects. Wall Street is a very secretive industry, and they tell all their employees, if you ever talk to the press, you're out of here. So as a component of their participation, I had to agree to keep all of them anonymous.
So let's talk about Arjun.
Yes.
Why profile him?
Well, I thought Arjun was an interesting character. I mean, what I wanted to do was to profile 8 people working in the financial industry who were young, who were not CEOs or billionaires, who were just starting out after the financial crisis, because this is an industry that takes so many people from the nation's top colleges. It's the largest destination for Ivy League graduates above any other industry. So Arjun was an interesting case because he had been sort of directly impacted by the financial crisis. He was scheduled to work at Lehman Brothers. And then when Lehman Brothers went under, he was without a job. And it was hugely upsetting for him to have worked so hard to get this offer and then to have to scramble to find something else. I also thought it was interesting. I mean, I wanted to assemble a diverse group. I didn't want it to be all, you know, blue bloods from Princeton. So he was a kid from Queens who had gone to a good school, but not an Ivy League school. And he had sort of worked his way up the ranks and onto Wall Street. And so I wanted to sort of see what it's like for someone who doesn't have the structural advantages that someone coming from Harvard or Princeton does. What it's like for someone who's just really ambitious and really smart, who's able to sort of like climb their way in.
So Arjun, born in Queens, goes to Fordham University, and so he's part of this picture you're painting of Wall Street is not just these blue bloods from the Ivy Leagues as you sort of think of them, or as we still think of them because they don't talk to the press very often. But Arjun, why did Lehman Brothers, the job he had, all of a sudden it's not there? Did he reconsider going into finance at all?
I don't think so. I mean, I think he had his heart set on it, and I think there's a sort of misconception about who goes onto Wall Street and why. When I started this book 4 years ago, I thought, you know, most people go into it purely for the money, and most of them are probably like lacrosse players from Princeton whose parents were bankers and they have Roman numerals after their names. And so I was surprised to learn that, you know, of the people who come to Wall Street, a lot are actually don't fit the stereotype. It's a lot are ethnic minorities, a lot are immigrants' kids, and they come for various reasons. And I think Arjun came because he wanted to make his parents proud. He wanted to do something. You know, his parents were immigrants, and I think he wanted to make money and be able to, you know, make their lives better. But money actually surprisingly wasn't the main motivation for some of the 8 people that I followed. For a lot of them, it was they just wanted some structure. They wanted something to do after college. These are 2-year jobs, so you're only committing to spending 2 years at a bank, and they teach you everything you need to know. You don't have to have majored in economics or finance. And it's a really easy way to sort of like put off the big decisions about what you want to do with your life until later. And you get to stay in this sort of collegiate-esque environment for 2 years at a bank.
Kevin Roos followed 8 Wall Street bankers who entered finance after the 2008 crash. And listeners, we want to take your calls about his new book, Young Money. I wonder if we get some calls from people who worked on Wall Street pre-crash, post-crash, what they've noticed changing, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We'll also talk with Kevin Roos about morality on Wall Street and how many of these young analysts grapple or ignore the moral implications of their work. Does that jibe with your experience if you work in finance? 212-433-WNYC. So we mentioned who is working on Wall Street now. A lot of that is driven by the recruiting practices of these firms. You describe it as very polite stalking. So describe how the recruiting, what were the messages that these firms were using post-crash to entice people to join their firms?
Well, Wall Street banks are very, very good at recruiting. They have done something that it's taken a lot of other companies a long time to catch up to, which is they've seized on the insecurities of college juniors and seniors about graduating from school and not having any marketable skills. So they come onto campus, they say, all you have to do is drop your resume into a box. That's it. Come to an information session. We'll tell you about the bank. If we like your resume, and you have good grades, we'll call you. We'll do an interview, and you'll have this locked up by September or October of your senior year, and then you can spend the rest of the year goofing off or whatever. So the messages, I think, have changed, though, because it used to be that these jobs marketed themselves. In 2006 at Princeton, if you had a job at graduation, there was a 46% chance that job was on Wall Street. And so you didn't need to do a whole lot of selling if you were Goldman Sachs. That changed, though, in the course of my reporting this book, because I talked to a number of people before and sort of during the Occupy Wall Street movement in 2011 and 2012, who said that the banks had actually been forced to address issues like morality. They had had to talk up their corporate social responsibility and all the things that they were doing for low-income communities. And it wasn't enough to just say, come here and make a lot of money. The people that they were talking to at colleges actually wanted to know that they'd be doing good in the world.
Interesting. So the recruiting practice is to look to juniors and seniors who are feeling anxiety about uncertainty in the post-college world. They entice them with this idea of you can come in, it's a two-year job, then you can do whatever, you know, suits you. They come into these jobs, they start those 2 years, and the best parts of your book describe in minute detail what that work actually is. I mean, what is the life like for a young banking analyst who's just out of college and shows up on Wall Street?
It's terrible. I mean, I thought this would be like the Wolf of Wall Street, and I'd be going to parties with cocaine and you know, Lamborghinis parked outside. And that is just not what it's like for 22-year-olds on Wall Street. They work these tremendous hours, and they're totally unpredictable. One banker said there's a thing called the banker 9-to-5, which is when you work from 9 a.m. until 5 a.m. the next day. So a 20-hour shift, and that's not uncommon. And basically, they can call you in at any moment. So if it's Christmas morning and your boss needs you to do some more revisions on an Excel spreadsheet, he can call you back to the office. And so one of the bankers I followed told me something interesting. He said, you know, it's not really the hours that kill you. It's the lack of control of the hours. So in other words, if you're planning an anniversary dinner with your boyfriend or girlfriend, if you're, you know, if you want to go on vacation, if you're, you know, you have plans that you've, you know, if you're in your best friend's wedding or something, that can all be interrupted at the spur of the moment by work calling you back. And so it creates this culture of constant anxiety, constant fear of being called back to work. And for a lot of the analysts I followed, it created real depression very early on.
A real sense of a lack of control over their lives, which is what drew them to the idea of a Wall Street job post-college anyway. But describe these Wall Street spreadsheets, because I think when people think of jobs in finance, they picture a lot of screens and a lot of data. But you actually got trained in Excel and what was going on. What's the work in those spreadsheets?
So I took an investment banking seminar that was 5 days of teaching us how to use Excel. And basically, it depends on what your job is within the bank. Obviously, traders have different jobs than bankers, who have different jobs than salespeople, and your exact function depends on that. But for investment bankers, a lot of the work is sort of taking a bunch of information about companies. So if Apple, is one of your clients, and they come to you and they say, you know, we want to buy, hypothetically speaking, Microsoft. Your job as the sort of junior analyst is to take all the information out there about Apple and its financials, all the information about Microsoft and its financials, put it all into a giant spreadsheet, do a bunch of calculations to try to figure out if this deal is a good idea or not, and how much, you know, Apple should be willing to pay to acquire this other company. So you're basically an information wrangler, and you create these. You know, I thought Excel spreadsheets were like pretty simple, but like these things grow to be monstrous. They take days to build, and they're like, you know, miniature sort of computer programs inside them to do all the different macros and you know, the different sheets of the balance statement and stuff like that. So it's a very intense process.
And at the end, good deal or bad deal is what the spreadsheet spells out. Lamar in Manhattan, what do you want to say to Kevin Roos and the look at young life on Wall Street?
I just wanted to say that the comment made just a few minutes ago regarding the new philosophy that besides coming to Wall Street and making money, that there's some good coming out of your efforts, and that's not really true. Matter of fact, it isn't true. You go to Wall Street, it's still the base of capitalism and economics, and the purpose of going there is to make money and to learn how to do it. How is it done? And who are the big players, and what are they doing that makes them successful and then acquiring those skills? And that is made very clear when the recruiters come in as to what they're looking for, the profile, the character in their questioning of the potential intern and future employee. They're asking you those questions to ascertain what you're thinking. Wall Street is about money. And
Lamar, do you have experience in finance?
Yeah, my background and still is securities and insurance. I happen to come in the way the author is describing, and that, you know, I certainly went to excellent schools and all of the top investment bankers are recruiting from there, but I had a previous career prior to this, and it was only through my efforts, individual entrepreneurial efforts, that I said, you know, this is where I really belong, this is where I want to focus, and this is what is exciting if you're going to understand our society and its future development. One other quick point is that if you look at the news stories and the analysis and discussions around the financial downturn and recession, the questions are still raised as to, you know, the fact that many of the arbiters of that financial downturn are unprosecuted, and that they made a lot of money, and that the American taxpayer had paid for it, and has paid for it, and will continue to, and that the industry really hasn't changed. What I think has changed, maybe because I'm older than who the clients or recruitees that the author interviewed, is that their enthusiasm or reasons for entering the industry certainly is different from mine, in that the technologies are there. They've grown up with a lot of these machines, that their conversations and obsessions are around these machines. So therefore, they understand that when a trade is being done, it's not taking minutes to do, it's milliseconds to do. So you have to be quick on your feet, you have to really think, and you have to be very obsessive and focused on what you're doing and where you want to go and how you plan to get there. And you just hope that someone, you'll find a mentor who will show you how that's done.
Kevin Roos, you describe working in finance as it's an amoral environment, not a lot of look at what's good or bad in terms of morality, but whether it's a good or bad deal. Respond to a bit of what Lamar is saying.
Well, I actually think she's right in that saying that Wall Street is at its base about making money. And what was really interesting about following these young financial analysts is watching them come to that realization. I remember one Goldman Sachs trader that I followed. You know, he came in and he thought, you know, maybe trading, you know, derivatives is actually good because it helps companies, you know, hedge their fuel costs and pass those savings on to the customer. And this is a valuable function. And he had sort of, you know, he had taken the bait on that. And midway through his time at the bank, his boss said something to him like, you know, we're here to make money. You know, if money is not your main priority here, you should leave. And so I think it was very to have the scales sort of and you know, obviously these young bankers, you can call them naive, but these are the lines that recruiters are pitching them. They're saying, you're not selling your soul if you're coming to Wall Street. These are the functions that we do, and this is why it makes the world a better place. And, you know, if you're 21 or 22, you might actually believe that. And so for them to have the sort of the scales, you know, fall from their eyes, it was very painful for them.
Oh, that's interesting. Lamar in Manhattan, thanks for your call. The phone number is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. So another line that you point out the recruiters use is this is a two-year commitment, just out of college, 2 years. This is what you're signing up for. Do they stay once they have that realization that this is not actually exactly what the recruiters described to me?
Some of them do and some of them don't. The attrition rate among young bankers is very high. Some of that's on purpose. They hire more than they intend to promote. After your 2 years are up, you're somewhat expected to leave, either to go to a private equity firm or a hedge fund or another type of finance. But actually something interesting happened midway through my book reporting is that people started leaving Wall Street altogether. A lot of them wanted to go to Silicon Valley and work at tech companies because tech companies were offering, they were offering the do-gooder ethos. And I don't, you know, I'm not sure how accurate that is, but they were at least, you know, saying to, and they made a concerted grab for, you know, disenchanted Wall Street analysts. And they said, come work for us at Facebook or Google. You can make some money. We'll, you know, it'll look just as prestigious on your resume. And you can help us, you know, change the world rather than just, you know, shaving off cents of every trade that passes through your hands.
So it's not the Silicon Valley, the pull to Silicon Valley you're saying is not just that that's the hot place to be where the action is happening. You're saying it's also because of the social vision that the tech industry promotes and what they say they're about.
I think it's about an equal amount of both. Yeah, I think it's sexy right now to work in tech in a way that it is not sexy to work on Wall Street. I had one guy, and I think Occupy was a sort of an inflection point in this. I remember that Goldman trader telling me, you know, during the Occupy Wall Street movement, that he actually had to lie about what he did when he went out. When he would go out to bars, when people would ask him what he did, he would say, "I'm a consultant." Rather than confess to being a Goldman Sachs employee. So I think, you know, the sex appeal of Silicon Valley is still much greater. And I also think that, you know, that it does capitalize on people's desire to do good in the world. I think as a generation, like people sort of this generation of young people wants to not only make money and be successful, but feel like they're having an impact. And Silicon Valley is able to promise that a lot more credibly than Wall Street is.
Sally in Lakewood, New Jersey, what do you want to add to the conversation?
Hi, good morning. I'm calling because I have a brother who's not, he's a little bit older. He graduated Amherst College. And when he went to Amherst College, his goal when they asked him when he went and was interviewed was, "I want to make a lot of money." And he knew from the get-go that he wanted to go into investment banking, and he knew that that was how he was going to do it. And he got into a major firm, and he made no bones about the fact that he was there to get rich, and he stayed beyond the two-year spin for several years and then spun off into his own company with some of the other people. But the thing is, I mean, it's not that, I don't know if I would call it a lack of morality. I'm sure it is also. But now that he's extremely successful beyond what anybody thought he would be, he's also very philanthropic. And so he makes a lot of money, and I'm not sure how, you know, I guess I'm saying there might be two sides to that in terms of your morals and your ethics. I don't know what happens in the business world. But I know that he had no life for a long time, and you're right, there's no control over your hours.
But now he has money to give to philanthropic efforts. Sally, thanks for your call. Kevin, I want to ask you about that, because one of the arguments you do hear from Wall Streeters, typically people at the top, is, look, you're maligning bankers. You don't understand how much good we do. We're helping the economy run. You don't know what would happen if we weren't doing what we're doing. Did you hear that from young bankers as well?
Some. I think some were stalwart defenders of the financial industry and thought that it provided legitimate capital markets functions. And And to some extent, I agree. I mean, we do need banks. Like we do need investment banks. And, you know, as long as we have investment banks, we probably need some 22-year-olds to be making the Excel spreadsheets. But I think my the thing that I came away from my reporting feeling was that our resources as a nation are very misallocated. We send these people who are not like the person just described who went to Amherst College and wanted to be an investment banker. I mean, those people have always gone to Wall Street. What happened in the buildup, in the last couple decades, is that there were all kinds of people going to Wall Street who didn't want to be bankers. They just wanted to do something for 2 years while they figured the rest of their lives out. And then a lot of them sort of got stuck by the money and the prestige. So there was sort of this generation of accidental bankers almost who never meant to do this as their career. And I think that's really coming to an end now. I think we're really reverting, because of Occupy, because of the crisis, it's reverting to a situation in which most of the people who come to work on Wall Street now actually want to be bankers and traders.
They mean to be going to Wall Street. I'm speaking with Kevin Roos. His new book is Young Money. It's a profile of 8 young bankers who joined Wall Street after the financial crash. I'm Anna Sale in for Brian Lehrer. This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. So of those 8 bankers, Kevin, the few that chose to leave Wall Street, what did they do next?
Some of them went into tech startups. I think that was a very appealing option for the reasons that I mentioned. And then a few just sort of went into other parts of finance where the hours were a little better and maybe the pay was a little bit less, but they felt like they had more control of their lives. The tech sort of converts are really interesting to me because I think in some ways Silicon Valley has now sort of taken over from Wall Street. If you look at the recruiting figures from places like Harvard Business School and Stanford, Wall Street and tech are basically flip-flopping. The number of graduates going into finance is falling, and the number of graduates going into technology is rising. And that's really interesting because I think what we're seeing is that, it used to be the sort of default option at schools like that to go to Wall Street, and now maybe those kids are going to Google instead. Maybe they're going to Teach for America. 1 in 6 Ivy League seniors now applies for Teach for America. So there are a lot more options. It's a lot, there's not one school where half the people go to Wall Street anymore. That just doesn't happen.
David in Manhattan, what do you want to add to the conversation? You there, David?
Yes, I am. When this gentleman said that the largest number of graduates from the nation's best schools go to Wall Street, it made my stomach turn. This whole discussion is infuriating to me. I spent 30 years in marketing in Wall Street-related businesses. The only function of investment banking in Wall Street, in my view, is to transfer wealth from the middle class to the 1%. That's the result that they have produced, and that's where we're going. And there's no stopping it because the government won't do anything. That's the bottom line. That's all I have to say.
David, thanks for your call. Kevin, how did young bankers deal with that question of were they making the world a better place or a worse place?
Well, this is one of the things that surprised me in my reporting is that I expected, we don't tend to think of Wall Street bankers as a particularly introspective bunch. But when I got to know these 8 young bankers and started talking to them and getting them to open up, they really started sort of pouring out all kinds of doubts and questions and fears. These are people who haven't really bought it yet. They haven't drunk the Kool-Aid, and they're still sort of – they have one foot in the real world and one foot on Wall Street. And so they grapple with this stuff really hard. And there were these 2 Goldman Sachs guys, again, who were so – distressed by their jobs that their way of coping was that they went and they took hallucinogenic mushrooms and they hoped that this would open up some new realization for them about how to spend their lives in a way that was better than just working at Goldman Sachs. And it was a real turning point for them to decide how they wanted to make that change. So I think that
wait what happened What did they learn?
I don't want to spoil the end of the book, but suffice to say that they made, you know, choices about their careers that you know, brought them to a place where they felt better about what they were doing. So I think that what should hearten people is that, you know, at the young level, it's not all like miniature Gordon geckos. It's not all people who just want to make a ton of money, have no concern for ethics. The people who are coming in are deeply concerned about this stuff, and I think that they grapple with it a lot more than anyone has ever known. You really have to sort of get them to, you know, open up to start saying, well, maybe I don't feel great about spending all day, you know, trading derivatives or making, you know, pitch books for mergers and things like that.
But I just want to finish on this idea of Wall Street exceptionalism, because you hit on it a little bit, that prior to the crash, there was this idea that if you were talented and type A and had done well in school, this was a place you might end up if accidentally. Post-crash, these bankers have to be a little bit more clear-eyed about their work and what it's going to be. Is there an idea among these young bankers, like, look, I like to do math. I majored in economics. This is what I can do. This is how I can serve the world. Finance exists. I'm among the exceptional few that need to be on Wall Street.
Yeah. In my book, I outline four types of people that I think actually do thrive as young people on Wall Street. And a few of those are, you know, the people who need the money, who don't come from privilege. I call them the locomotives because they're pulling their families behind them. A lot of times they're sort of the meal ticket for their families, and they're paying off student debt. The other category is sort of the people who really like the markets, the geeks, the people who obsess over bond prospectuses and who read, you know, the stock reports daily. Those people tend to like it too. There are also people who grew up around a lot of money and just want to make a lot of money so that they can continue that lifestyle. And then there's another group of people who enjoy the pace of it and the sort of thrill and the challenge of waking up every day and sort of attacking the markets. And so I think those people actually tend to do okay on Wall Street. It's the other people. It's the people who don't have a really clear reason for being there that I think end up being the most miserable.
Mel in Manhattan, how do you think Wall Street has changed since the crash?
Hello.
Hi, go ahead. You're on WNYC.
Oh, yes, hi. My question is regarding the notion of regulation. I heard a show, I think, on Brian Lehrer about a guy wrote a book called In Bed with Wall Street, and how deregulated Wall Street is actually today, even more so than the crash of 08, because there's an agency that self-regulates them, which is a joke, because they were even using inside information to trade for themselves, the organization that's regulating them. That's not too kosher. And also, I found out from this book, he said that Congress was actually legally allowed to trade insider trading until it was exposed recently, and they finally ended that. So to me, it sounds like what the gentleman who called earlier said, their real motive is to move all the money from the middle class to the upper 1/10 of 1% probably.
Mel, thanks for your...
That's my opinion, but I'm just asking, how do you feel the risk of the deregulatory environment could cause an even greater potential crash for the next time?
Thanks for your call, Mel. So, Kevin, I want to ask you, I mean, your framing is post-financial crash. How or where were these young bankers about a new reality in terms of regulation? And did they talk about the sense that the feeling of a crisis had passed and maybe there wasn't fearing regulation, that sort of did it dissipate as your reporting continued?
Right. I think from Wall Street's perspective, the financial crisis changed everything. They feel like they've done a 180-degree turn. We might not see that, you know, as consumers and people who are watching from the outside. But I heard one banker say, you know, I've come to terms with the fact that 2007 is never coming back. These banks are smaller, you know, they're better capitalized now. I think some of the new regulations that have been written, like the Dodd-Frank Act, have actually made it a safer place. And in some ways, that's part of what, you know, the young people don't like, the ones who want to make a lot of money. They say, you know, we're never going to get those go-go days back. It's never going to be, you know, the Wolf of Wall Street again. And that was what you know, attracted me to the industry. So I do think we need more and better regulation. But this is not a policy book. I wanted to really focus in on these eight people and say, what are their lives like, and how are they coming of age in an industry that is going through such a tremendous upheaval? And that, you know, there have been plenty of other books written about what we should do in response to the crisis, but I really wanted to tell some human stories and put faces to sort of the stereotypes.
Young Money is the new book from Kevin Roos, Inside the Hidden World of Wall Street's Post-Crash Recruits. Thanks so much for joining us, and keep the conversation going online. I'm feeling a lot of emotion from you callers out there. Kevin Roos, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
After the break, physicist Brian Green will be in to talk about the new science courses available online.